In the morning of 9 February 1649, following the Gregorian calendar, the King of England, Charles I, was led onto the scaffold erected at Whitehall after having been convicted as a traitor to his people. This event came at the end of two civil wars that bathed England in blood for nearly 7 years. It was greeted with horror by all governments of Europe. In the days immediately following the death of the king, what remained of the Long Parliament after the so-called Bride's Purge in December 1648 approved the abolition of the House of Lords and the monarchy and instituted a Council of State. In May 1649, the Commonwealth was formally proclaimed. In December 53, the Protectorate was proclaimed, that became hereditary in 1657. And after the death of Protector Oliver Cromwell in September 58, a conscious political phase started that opened the way for the restoration of the Stuart monarchy. The only Italian prince who maintained a diplomatic delegation in England without interruption throughout these years was the Grand Duke of Tuscany. And when Charles I was beheaded, none of the other Italian states had a resident or an agent formally approved by the Parliament. The Court of Rome, after the adventurous departure of Count Carlo Rossetti, nuncio to Queen Henrietta Maria, in June 1641, for obvious reasons, had no more an official representative in London. The Republic of Venice, after the sudden death of his agent, Girolamo Agostini, in February 1645, decided not to appoint any successor, hoping for a quick normalization of the situation and re-establish diplomatic relations with England only in the spring of 1652, while the Republic of Genoa appointed its resident only in the autumn of 1651. In investigating their attitudes towards events in contemporary England, most noteworthy is that the court receiving by far the most accurate and detailed news was the Tuscan. This is largely due to its highly efficient and very capable resident Amerigo Salvetti. Just to make a single and significant example, it is widely known that when civil war broke out in England during the summer of 1642, none of the leaders of parliamentary party openly advocated abolishing the monarchy. A mere 2 years later, however, some members of the Long Parliament interviewed the Venetian diplomatic representative in London, seeking detailed information on the political regime of the most serene Republic of Venice. The request came at the same moment as Henry Vane's trip to Scotland, where he sought to launch negotiations with the government. The Tuscan resident in England, Amerigo Salvetti, reported to the Court of Florence on 24 June 1644 that the parliamentarians had sent one of their leaders to Scotland. More significantly, he added that this had been probably done not for petty reasons, but to convince that nation to join them to depose His Majesty and to transform that Scotland and this England kingdom in a republic. The main evidence sustentation Amerigo Salvetti's thesis was that some members of Parliament requested earnestly to this agent of Venice to provide them in writing or printing the constitutions of the government of that republic. The Venetian agent at that time was Girolamo Agostini, and this is significant since it demonstrates that someone had already begun thinking about a new form of state in England. But also, for the topic of this evening, it is interesting to know that such an important news was not referred by Girolamo Agostini himself, who in his dispatches does not mention this at all, but instead, as I said, by the Tuscan resident. For this reason, before talking more specifically on the correspondence of Amerigo Salvetti and his son and successor as resident, Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli, and to rightly assess the value of the Tuscan readings of the English Revolution, I think it is probably necessary to give an account of the diplomatic relations between England and the other two Italian states that maintain diplomatic representation in London in the mid-17th century, that is the Republic of Genoa and Venice. When Charles I summoned the Long Parliament, Giovanni Giustinian had been in London 2 years as ambassador of the Republic of Venice. In London, Giustinian's attention had already long been focused primarily on British foreign policy, while almost completely ignoring domestic political developments. The content of his dispatches changed only when it became impossible to discount the importance of the clash between the king and the parliament. Unlike the majority of foreign ministers in London, Giustiniani refused to seek relations with the parliamentary leaders, whom he regarded with some disdain, considering them to be essentially personally ambitious and ignoring the country's welfare. Most of his information came from the court of Charles I, and this, of course, made his dispatches unilateral and at times completely detached from reality. For example, it is significant to note that when Justinian spoke of Parliament, he was almost always referring solely to the House of Lords rather than the Commons. In December 1642, Ambassador Giustiniani left England. The aforementioned Girolamo Agostini, who has been his secretary in London, remained as resident and continued to send weekly reports on the development of the civil war for the next 2 years. Agostini's main source of information, like that of his predecessor, came almost exclusively from court circles. When Agostini died suddenly, in February 1645, as I already said, he was not replaced. In fact, the civil war and the constitutional crisis led the Venetian Senate to suspend diplomatic relations with England, which remained interrupted for over 7 years. It was not until April 1652 that the Venetian Republic sent Lorenzo Paoluzzi, already secretary to the ambassador in Paris, to London. But Paoluzzi had to wait 7 months before being formally recognized. And that because following the beheading of Charles Stuart, the Venetian Republic accredited Thomas Killigrew, an envoy with the credential of Charles II, as the English representative. His presence was obviously a barrier to the establishment of regular diplomatic relations between the two countries. Therefore, only after the royalist agent was abruptly deprived of his position in Venice, could Paoluzzi have his first audience in England. The troubles that the lack of recognition caused to Paoluzzi probably nurtured his growing contempt for the British government, which exudes from his dispatches. In the fall of 1655, Giovanni Sagredo finally came to England as extraordinary ambassador. After a long series of unsubstantial second-rank figures came a diplomat of great experience and considerable intellect. From his very first dispatch, a hostile view of the protector and his government, more feared than loved, as he wrote to Venice, was evident. In the final report of his embassy, prepared upon his return to Venice, Sagredo reflected on the events that had led to the most tempestuous civil war in which the royal authority ultimately suffered dire shipwreck. King Charles, according to Sagredo, was, I'm quoting, endowed with a placid temperament, infinite goodness, and unmatched sincerity. And the error that had precipitated his downfall was his, I quote, failure to stand up against Parliament at the outset, imitating those rivers when the first flush is neglected, that end by suddenly breaking their banks, carrying away the tardy repairs which were undertaken too late. A phrase in which an echo of Machiavelli's Prince is clearly discernible. According to the Venetian ambassador, Parliament from the outset had the support of those who hoped to improve their own fortune amid the ruin of the countries, I'm quoting. After briefly recounting the events leading to the beheading of Charles I, an example, as it was defined by Sagredo, probably quoting the title of a Latin pamphlet published in Paris in 1649, a royalist pamphlet, of course, the report went on to describe Cromwell's rise to power, a man whose fortune and history have rendered the most famous of the present age. In describing the advent of the protectorate, the ambassador bluntly defined it as a military rule, stating that Cromwell left the Council of State merely, I quote, to keep up the appearance of a republic. The only reason why Cromwell was not proclaimed king was that, having done his part to overthrow the royal dignity under the cloak of public zeal, his ascension to throne would have lifted the mask of hypocrisy hiding naked ambition. After Sagredo's departure in February 1656, the Venetian diplomatic representative, Secretary Francesco Giavarina, who initially came to England with ambassador, remained in London until January 1663. A renewed 5-year interruption in Anglo-Venetian diplomatic relations followed his departure. The general consideration regarding the interpretative framework featured in all reports and during 1640s and 1650s by the other Venetian resident mentioned above also applied to Giavarina's weekly dispatches. though his intelligence service were often defective and sometimes overlooked events that were central to British politics. This summary of the evolution of Anglo-Venetian diplomatic relations in the years of the Civil War and Interregnum makes clear the degree to which Venice was uninterested in England. Likewise, clear is Venetian hostility towards the parliamentary side of the conflict and sympathy for the royalist cause. The Republic of Venice, therefore, considered as a possible model, if only for propaganda reason, by the first English Republicans, for example, the request from the Venetian Constitution to resident Agostini mentioned at the beginning of the talk, was hostile to the English Republican Revolution. Consequently, Venice supported the Stuarts within the boundaries of its foreign policy and welcomed the Restoration with relief. It is possible to identify ideological motifs that contributed to the Venetian hostility, so many traces of which are found in the dispatches of Venetian diplomats in England towards the transformation of the British monarchy into a republic. It is evident that many contemporary Venetian intellectuals, brought both from a political and religious perspective, were sympathetic to the Stuart monarchy and the ecclesiastical policy of Archbishop William Laud. This is particularly evident within the milieu more sympathetic to Sarpi's legacy. For many observers, the Armenian politics pursued by Charles I and Archbishop Laud constitute a continuum with those of James I. It is reasonable to assume that Irenic hopes that had matured during the reign of Charles I further were projected over Laud's policy. Among early Venetian elite, sympathy towards the established Church of England that, despite its break with Rome, had maintained the episcopal hierarchy was manifest. The demolition of the ecclesiastical system and its substitution with what was perceived to be a more rigid Calvinistic orthodoxy during the English Revolution was regarded as the construction of a new spiritual tyranny. From the perspective of state organization, Venice had always appreciated the English mixed monarchy. If Charles I has been misguided in trying to alter the balance of power in order to reign without convening parliament, his assassination and the Republican experiment were considered a tragic mistake that led to the dominion by rude multitude. In fact, the Venetian thought that the British king in parliament, seen as a sort of doge, represented a model of government very close to the Venetian one. In contrast, the Puritan Commonwealth was regarded as a fanatical government of ambitious and noble men and the protectorate a military dictatorship. The Republic of Genoa, in contrast to that of Venice and the Grand Duke of Tuscany, as we will see, did not have a long tradition of political and diplomatic relations with England. Except for the ambassadors who arrived in England at the time of Mary Tudor, only one resident went to London at the end of the 1500s. No one was dispatched until 1651, when Francesco Bernardi, born in England in 1627, to an English mother and a merchant, who had settled there at the beginning of the century, was appointed an agent for the Republic of Genoa. His father, who had always served the Spanish ambassador, subsequently returned to Genoa. Francesco remained and joined, as his father had, his mercantile activities to the service of the Spanish crown. In July 1651, Francesco was elected consul of Genoa in London and formally appointed agent to the English Commonwealth a month later. He married an English woman, and one of his daughters married a relative of General Charles Fleetwood. It is probably this connection with one of the most important Cromwellian generals that permitted Francesco Bernardi to establish a personal relationship with the future protector of England, with whom we know he had private and unofficial meetings. And so Bernardi, unlike the Venetian diplomats who drew their information mainly from royalist sources, had constant access to Cromwell's inner circle. In all Bernardi's dispatches and during the interregnum, his admiration for Albert Cromwell is evident. It is significant that Bernardi went far to justify English policy even in cases where it was directed against Catholics. For example, in one such case in 1655, in recounting an anti-Catholic measure, he suggested explicitly that the protector had been forced to do so in order to deny rumours spread by Presbyterians that only Papists were heard in Cromwell's court. In his reports to Genoa, Bernardi often presented himself as a good friend of the protector. So clearly this relationship was accentuated to emphasize his usefulness. His words, when delivering news of the protector's death, seemed to reflect genuine profound sorrow. Bernardi wrote that the, I'm quoting, death of their sincere friend Serene Olivario Protector was the worst news he was ever being compelled to write since he was appointed as agent, and went so far as saying that even his enemies have just cause to regret that the world is deprived of such a magnanimous and generous spirit. Anglo-Genoese closeness of those years is further evidenced by the posting of an extraordinary ambassador in 1655, whose intention was to convince the English government to move the axis of its Mediterranean commerce from Livorno to Genoa. The Genoese ambassador was received with royal honors, eliciting protests from the Spanish ambassador Alonso de Cárdenas and the Venetian resident Paoluzzi. Fieschi, in his weekly dispatches to Genoa, unreservedly praised Oliver Cromwell and his policies. I'm quoting, "The protector is a great man, more than everyone can imagine. He has wide thoughts and is timely in his decisions." Back home, Fieschi produced a very favorable report on the situation of British politics, which was commented on with satisfaction by Charles Longland, Cromwell's agent in Italy. With the restoration of the Republic of Genoa, determined that Bernardi had proved too open in favor of the Commonwealth and of the Protector, and reduced his rank to envoy. In 1661, when Genoa sent an ambassador to congratulate Charles II for his restoration, the English master of ceremonies defended Bernardi to him, justifying his familiarity with Cromwell, saying that he was only following the general practice to apparently take side with the successful rulers. Significantly, he added that Bernardi had often helped some royalists during the interregnum. Despite gaining, as we see, the support of the new authorities, demonstrating his unusual flexibility and adaptability, Bernardi was not reinstated as agent. The Republic of Genoa maintained him in the post of envoy until the end of 1664. Instead of returning to Italy, he devoted himself to gardening in Worcestershire and was naturalized in October 1675. In conclusion to this rapid overview of Anglo-Venetian and Anglo-Genoese diplomatic relations, we can say that the two Italian republics, to which even in an instrumental way England looked as possible models, never manifested an ideological solidarity with the British republicans, whom did they not understand, did not like, and even despised. Bernardi considered the republicans, Harry Vane, Harry Martin, and Thomas Chaloner, simply as pensioner of Spain. And the Genoese and Venetian ambassador were in agreement condemning regicide as patricide. The perception that emerges from the Genoese and the Venetian diplomatic missions of the Civil War and of the events of the interregnum is limited. All concede that the events of extraordinary interest, which had important consequences in the European balance of power, but essentially had no meaning for contemporary Italy. The political reading of the English events by the Venetian and Genoese diplomats clearly derived from Machiavelli. Paradoxically, this very system of interpretation, an exhausted and worn-out Machiavellism, may have constituted the major obstacle to a true understanding of what was really happening in England. The English turbulence were perceived as a consequence of the intrigues of ambitious people who exercised power by virtue of skill and luck. As a result, reflection on the meaning of the English Republican experience and the broader implication of the religious and political debate isn't really lacking. And now, let's go to Amerigo Salvetti. Salvetti's real name was Alessandro Antelminelli. Born in Lucca in 1572, he belonged to one of the most prestigious families of the city, which boasted the descent of Castruccio Castracanis. Initiated into mercantile activities, early on Alessandro moved to Antwerp in the employ of a Florentine company. The dramatic turning point that abruptly changed his life and his fate happened in 1596. In that year, his father, Bernardino Antelminelli, was accused by the Lucca magistrates of being on the payroll of the Grand Duke of Tuscany and was consequently arrested in Genoa. Searches of his city house and villa in San Columbano brought to light a number of incriminating documents that verified the allegations. The trial that was soon launched against him and his sons revealed a vast conspiracy against the integrity of the Republic of Lucca and a plot to unite it with the domains of the Grand Duke of Tuscany. All male family members were sentenced to death and executed, but Alessandro. When Alessandro, who had come voluntarily to Italy for trial, learned of the fate of his father and brothers, he was naturally careful not to travel to the territory of Lucca and fled to Florence. Thereafter, he left Italy, went to London, and assumed the new identity of Amerigo Salvetti, hoping to cover his tracks. However, his cover was known almost immediately in Lucca, and Amerigo Salvetti evaded his assassin sent by the General Council of Lucca several times over the next few years. In his early years of exile, Amerigo did not live permanently in England. Some of his stays of varying length in Holland and France are documented, as is his time in Italy in the retinue of the English ambassador to Venice, Wotton. In summer 1660, Salvetti apparently made his last trip across the Channel. And in that same year, 20 years after the beginning of his exile, Salvetti made a real attempt to have his sentence revoked by sending petition to the city authorities of Lucca. But he was unsuccessful. As soon as Salvetti understood that the possibility for returning to Lucca were fading, he sought and obtained employment in England with the authorities of the duchy, and began sending regular dispatches to Florence on 1st February 1617, collaborating with the Tuscan resident in London, Francesco Quaratresi. When Quaratresi returned home in 1618, Salvetti formally succeeded him as resident. In October 1635, Salvetti, already in his 60s, married with the young Frances Colbrand, daughter of a Catholic baronet. He thus became related to the Earl of Bolingbroke, who would later be a prominent member of the Long Parliament, along with his brother. Salvetti's first son, Giovanni, was born at Worden in Bedfordshire in August 1636. Amerigo was 64 years old at the time. When Amerigo died in London, age 85, in 1657, Giovanni succeeded him as Tuscan resident, returning to the pseudonym of Salvetti, as well as a family name Antelminelli, Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli. The transition between father and son had been planned for some time in the Tuscan court, seconding Amerigo's pressing demands. To make Giovanni suitable for the post, the Grand Duke subsidized his studies at a Jesuit college in Normandy. The young Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli proved unable to live up to the task that he had been entrusted with. As the Venetian resident Francesco Giavarina emphasized in his communique to Venice with the news of Amerigo's death, quote, "The scanty ability of this person, a youth not yet 20, who knows no Italian, being born and bred in this country and more used to the customs of England than those of his fatherland." The genuine resident Francesco Bernardi sarcastically defined him as the little resident, il residentino, in his dispatches. Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli filled the post until the beginning of 1680, when he was replaced by the Florentine merchant Francesco Terresi. However, he continued to receive a pension from the Secretary of State Gregorio Leti, who settled in England 2 months after the change of two residents. Noted that it was a few years that Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli had but the title of resident, having no inclination for court affairs. Leti added that he used to spend most of the year in the countryside and delegate all his diplomatic business to Terresi. The octogenarian Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli died in London in March 1716. Just to point out the importance of the Tuscan diplomatic residency for the circulation of news about English events in Italy, it is also noteworthy to mention that from 1645 or 1643, we don't know, Gilles Chessy, a learned French Franciscan known in England as Father St. Giles, was a key figure of Roman intelligence network in England, lived with Salvetti as his chaplain. Chassy, who died in September 1658, in the summer of 1637 was employed by the French ambassador Bellievre to convey messages between him and the army leaders, and between April 1646 and September 1650 sent a series of letters to the court of Rome. This newsletter, unsigned, were used extensively by Gardiner in his History of the Civil War and Commonwealth without having been able to ascertain the writer's identity. And Gardiner emphasized that they are written with an authority not usually enjoyed by a writer of newsletters. Both Amerigo and Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli used to send a newsletter, Foglio di Avvisi, to Tuscany each week. Usually prepared on Tuesday, the events of the week were summarized in an essential and concrete manner, along with another letter we concerned more directly their task as residents, a letter of affairs, lettera di negozio. The latter, sometimes written in cipher, also provided news that was not possible to include in the newsletter and was completed on Friday, shortly before sending everything to the post. So, following the practice of Tuscan diplomacy, when sending this letter of affairs, which included the newsletter, Tuscan residents formally distinguished their dual role as informers and diplomats of the prince. These two documents present themselves very differently. The letter of affairs, lettera di affari, is written in first person, signed and addressed to a specific addressee, the Secretary of State, at the time the Bali Giovan Battista Gondi, starting each letter of affairs with "My most illustrious and most honorable lord, illustrissimo signor mio, signor colendissimo." In contrast, the newsletter is written as a chronicle in the third person singular of the Italian impersonal form. Si dubita, si conclude, si sussurra, si vede, one doubts, we conclude, it is whispered, one sees. It is anonymous and unsigned and not addressed to a specific person. In this regard, it is indeed highly probable that the newsletters were prepared by Salvetti in several copies and sent simultaneously to the Florentine Secretariat of State as well as other addressees. Certainly, at least during the years in which the Republic of Venice, as we have seen, lacked a resident in England, a copy of Salvetti's newsletter was sent to the representative of the Venetian Republic in Florence. Once in Florence, the Secretary of State likely sent copies to the Tuscan residents in other European capitals and Italian states, or at least passed relevant information to other diplomatic representatives. When Amerigo Salvetti replaced Quaratresi, he had been living in England for almost 20 years. He had a perfect command of the English language, and over time had built up a series of relationships with the British political and economic establishment that allowed him to get first-hand news not only from the court, parliament, and London mercantile circles, but also from the provincial Catholic nobility. Sometimes he included copies of English documents translated into Italian in his correspondence. Just to take one example, a report of the Battle of Worcester. But this was rather rare. Between 1649 and 1657, I counted no more than a dozen among some 700 newsletters. He had an extraordinary narrative ability. Reading his newsletters in their simplicity and succinctness is compelling. Anyone who is familiar with 17th century Italian prose can certainly appreciate how rarely this can be said, either for letters conceived to remain as manuscript or for printed political chronicles. I would not wish reading the full 2,300 pages of the multi-volume Mercurio, authored by Vittorio Siri and dedicated to the English events, on my worst enemy. I've done that for my PhD thesis 20 years ago. Please, I read the few lines with which Salvetti gives news of the dissolution of the Long Parliament on 20 April 1653, at the end of his newsletter for that week. "Very unexpectedly, yesterday morning, they saw the execution of the resolution taken by the commanders of the armies to dissolve this parliament. When they brought him to it, and on their own authority, the speaker was lifted from his seat with dismay, and they sent him with the rest of members of parliament at home. So now we are without a parliament, and as a result, we are also without the state council, and without knowing what sort of government they want to give to us. All this is followed very quietly and without any popular commotion. Molto inaspettatamente si vide ieri mattina mettere in esecuzione, etc., etc. The information is given without indulging in lengthy descriptions and without expressing Salvetti's personal judgment. But in a few lines he is able to show clearly both all the uncertainty of the situation and the fact that the power resides now completely in the hands of the army, the people, in whose name Parliament and condemned to death the legitimate ruler, not only does not intervene in its defense, but is indifferent to its fate. It is only one example, but in my view effectively shows the style of his newsletters. They follow a certain pattern. The events of the week are recorded in strict chronological order. The narrative is concise and there are no explicit comments. In comparison with our time, sorry for the anachronism, but these newsletters more closely resemble wire service reports than newspaper articles. Salvetti's narrative ability makes for an extraordinary and very accurate chronicle of the events of those years, and above all, an important chapter in the history of the politics of information in the early modern age. In contrast to Amerigo's dispatches, those authored by his son, Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli, were quite disappointing. Giovanni's newsletter simply summarized news carried in English news book in poor Italian, grammatically incorrect, bent syntax, and full of anglicism. At the end of August 1655, Cromwell ordered the closure of all not government newspapers, leaving only the Mercurius Politicus appearing every Wednesday and the Public Intelligence appearing every Monday. Giovanni Salvetti Antelminelli merely provided translation, often hasty and awkward, of the news carried by these journals. It is therefore not worth dwelling on his writings except to point out the gulf that separates them from those of his father, and also noteworthy are the dividends of the Antelminelli's loyalty to the Medicis, for which a heavy bloody toll, as I said, was paid at the time, which definitely played a role in ensuring to such an incompetent diplomat was maintaining this station for some 30 years. And as I said, he got a pension after that, that lasted until his death. Returning to Amerigo Salvetti's dispatches, there are several interesting and significant aspects to consider. The first thing that catches your attention, even upon a cursory reading, is the fact that the key to interpreting English events of the period is purely political. Religious issues, which played a large part in these events and in the political debate, remain the background. Simultaneously, there is no sign of significant reflection, neither on the more general meaning of the institutional debate, nor on the real economic interests on the ground. Cromwell's acts, as a case in point, are primarily considered as an expression of army's will. The soldatesca, the army, serves as one of the protagonists in Tuscan dispatches. Also in Salvetti's case, this way of interpreting historical events is the result of a cultural education debt to the Machiavellian tradition. The resulting ideological perspective heavily influences Salvetti's judgment of contemporary British events. The Civil War, the passing of the King's death sentence, the proclamation of the Republic, and the advent of the Protectorate are for Salvetti by no means what we would call a social or political or religious revolution. Moreover, a deterministic or theological vision of history is completely absent. Instead, each event results from the concatenation of determined actions and simply explained by the interplay of personalities. And in this context, obviously, have a great significance both foreign policy and commercial and mercantile implications. Consequently, a pragmatic history where the free and sometimes random actions of people determine events emerges from Salvetti's narrative. politics, thus understood, is the keystone to Salvetti's interpretation, and as I said, is completely absent from deterministic teleological vision of history. But comparing his letters to those of the Venetian Genoese diplomats makes his remarkable political insight to stand out. It is certainly true that while ostensibly neutral in form, his newsletters belied a monarchical ethos and certain contempt for the republicans of the parliament, republicanti, and Cromwell's soldiers, soldatesca. But we must not forget that from Salvetti's point of view, as well as the interests of the Tuscan court, a governed stability was paramount. One cannot trade with a country torn by civil war and internal divisions. Consequently, a stable government, though despicable and comprised of coarse people who ignore and accept a diplomatic protocol, was still better than chaos and disorder. So it is unsurprising that the advent of the protectorate was welcomed as an element of stabilization. The lettere di negozio, are obviously different. There Salvetti uses the first person singular. There are sometimes references to the payment of the depository. Amerigo sometimes speaks of his children. In these uncertain, tumultuous years, is feared that the precariousness of the political situation may lead the Tuscan government to recall him is palpable. Already in 1643, he wrote that if he was forced to leave England, he would not have known where to retire or how to live. Salvetti, already elderly, did not want to leave his adopted country, and to illustrate the point, after the Battle of Worcester, he ordered his government to formally recognize the Commonwealth, and this was his personal condition as arguments concerning Anglo-Tuscan relations. Time, an obvious factor, but always worth examining, played a pivotal role in the diplomacy of the early modern era. Letters from England took a month to arrive in Florence. And so from the time the Tuscan Rising asked the question about how to deal with a certain situation to when he could act on the basis of orders received from the court of the Grand Duke, usually 2 months passed. Obviously, this is not the place to examine the history of political and diplomatic relations between Ferdinand II and the England of the Revolution. This is what the letters of affairs dealt with. What is important to emphasize is that the Tuscan interest in having precise information on British events and developing and maintaining friendly relations with England was mainly the result of England's increasing importance for the Mediterranean economy, and Tuscany in particular. If during the reign of King James one can speak of an Anglo-Venetian moment in the relationships between Italy and England, we can certainly speak of an analogous Anglo-Tuscan moment from the 1630s onward. Livorno, in mid-600s, was already the leading English port for the Levant, and its British factory was the most important English community in Italy, both in terms of turnover and number of merchants. The heat tensions between England and Tuscany was reached in March 1653, when during the Anglo-Dutch War, a squadron of British ships was defeated by the Dutch of Leghorn. The Grand Duke's favor against the latter was obvious. The neutrality of the port of Livorno was at play, and the Grand Duke's decision in the matter was certainly influenced by the Dutch seeming to have the upper hand during the ongoing battles between Holland and England. And Salvetti played an important role in mending the frayed relations between Tuscany and England. It was primarily to protect Leghorn, Livorno business, that the Grand Duchy's authorities, instinctively hostile to regicide and Republican England, did not offer concrete help to the pretender to the throne, Charles II, even when this was requested directly in 1649, at a stage when the new English Republican government was universally considered vulnerable. It was also for this reason that after the advent of the Protectorate, the relationship between Ferdinand II and Cromwell were marked by great cordiality and esteem manifested by expensive gifts sent regularly from Tuscany to London. Tuscans tried in vain to send wine to the Protector, but the long sea voyage soured the wine in the cask every time, much to poor Salvetti's distress. The Grand Duke sent Cromwell his portrait, a box full of perfume, and repeatedly Parmesan and Marzolino cheeses, Bologna sausages, and the like. He also made, through Salvetti, the request to place the Protector's portrait in the gallery of Palazzo Pitti, a request that, in the Grand Duke's estimation, should have pleased Cromwell more than the food gift. But we are led to believe that Cromwell actually appreciated the Parmesan more. Salvetti wrote his letter and enclosed his newsletter, as usual, on 22 June 1657. The next week he fell ill and was unable to hold the pen in hand, as his son Giovanni wrote. The death of this faithful servant of the Medici family was announced 2 weeks later. What he left us, without a doubt, is the most comprehensive Italian chronicle of the events of the English Revolution. Thank you.